Welcome back to the Bitcoin Layer. My name is Joe Consorti. Today we're here with a very special guest, Drew Armstrong, the president and chairman of Cathedra Bitcoin. Post-halving, there's a lot to discuss. I'm very happy to have him on the show. Drew, thanks so much for coming on.
Absolutely. Thanks for having me, Joe.
Absolutely. Well, you know, first things first, I kind of want to dive into, I guess, a brief intro of who you are, what you do, and kind of what Cathedra Bitcoin is. And then we'll dive a little bit more into the mining market, equities, halving, transaction fees, a lot to cover there. But first things first, why don't you give our viewers a little intro?
Yeah, definitely. So my name is Drew Armstrong. I'm the president and chairman of Cathedra. As Joe said, we are a publicly traded Bitcoin mining company on the Toronto Stock Exchange Venture Board. We're actually one of the first publicly traded mining companies that went public back in 2018. But myself and AJ Scalia were recruited to come take over the business in Q3, Q4, 2021. Prior to that, we both were co-founders of the Galaxy Digital Mining Team, which is now led by Brian Wright and Austin Storms. But we're traditionally a prop miner, meaning we buy ASICs and our long hash price. But a few months ago, we announced a merger with a company called Kungsleden Inc. that is a data center developer that specializes in building data centers for hosting Bitcoin mining quickly and cheaply. So that transaction hopefully will be closing in the next month or so here. And beyond that, we'll be mostly actually in the hosting business, in the data center development business, versus buying ASICs and plugging them in for ourselves. So that's some background on the business. And I think really this ties into some other trends that I'm sure we'll talk about today, namely consolidation, but also the shift towards other types of data center development as well among Bitcoin miners.
Hold that thought, we're gonna get back to it in a moment. First, a word from our friends over at River. River is our Bitcoin exchange of choice. You can invest in Bitcoin with confidence today over at river.com. Why do we love them so much? Well, they have multi-sig cold storage and they have 100% full reserve custody. So all the Bitcoin that you buy with them is held by them and nobody else. This is in contrast to a great deal of the other crypto exchanges that often lends out customers Bitcoin. River keeps it all in-house in a proprietary cold storage solution. They're also licensed and regulated all around the United States. You can check if they're available in your state, and they have full US-based phone support 24/7. And the best part of it all is that they have zero fees when you set up recurring orders with them. Most people buy Bitcoin via DCA or dollar cost averaging. That's how I advise buying Bitcoin. It gives you the best returns overall in the market than just doing lump sum buys. And River lets you do that on any time frame with zero fees whatsoever. So check them out today at river.com/TBL and get up to $100 in Bitcoin when you buy Bitcoin. Now on with the show.
Absolutely. Absolutely. Well, kind of piggybacking off of the discussion of Bitcoin miners, publicly traded mining stocks, you know, we saw earlier this year, there was a pretty big decoupling between Bitcoin's price and mining equities. Mining equities usually kind of move with high beta to Bitcoin's price, which is already beta to the market. Obviously, we had the halving coming up. Do you think there were any other factors that were contributing to this divergence?
Yeah, you know, it was interesting because I think all Bitcoin miners, I think typically, if you look at the stock chart for any of these Bitcoin miners, they basically run on 4-year cycles, very similar to Bitcoin. But you know, as you say, our beta is greater than one, so they're even more volatile. Some of these mining charts look much like shitcoins. But to your point, there was a lot of concern coming around with the halving. I think the ETF also played a large role here, right? Where historically, the only real ways you could get exposure to Bitcoin in your, you know, 401k on Charles Schwab was either buying miners or buying MSTR. I was dead wrong earlier this year when on a Twitter Spaces with our friend Dylan LeClaire said that the ETF was very bad for MicroStrategy, but very bullish for miners. And clearly the opposite sort of panned out so far this year. But I think there were concerns around the halving. Network hash rate was on the rise as well. You know, really has just continued to go up and through the right, even through the last bear market. But I think maybe on a more simple sort of microeconomic level, I think there might have also just been too many shares of Bitcoin miners being issued at that time. Miners now are all using their ATM shelf offerings in order to raise equity to expand their operations, sometimes even fund their OPEX as well. And so I think in simple terms, when the Bitcoin price was going up, but the share price for miners was flat to down. I think it could just have been as simple as there were more shares being issued and being sold than there was demand for. And so I think that entire confluence of factors really led to that underperformance from miners at the start of the year. I think maybe the lone exception would be CleanSpark, which has sort of been the darling of the last 12 months in mining. And that could just be the massive growth that they'd seen made them a really hot name that investors were still really wanting to get behind. But yeah, I think you're right that post-halving, it was really characterized by underperformance relative to Bitcoin.
For sure. So CleanSpark, obviously, they were an energy company before they transitioned into being like hugely Bitcoin mining. Do you think any other there's any other reason behind their outperformance? Do you think it's the fact that aren't they the company, and I apologize for not being more up to speed on this, but aren't they the company that's using like wind and solar and all these other renewable forms of energy to try to mine Bitcoin? Is that a huge part of what they're doing, or am I
wrong? Yeah, you know, I think that is right. In fact, I think Zach and the CleanSpark team were originally more in the renewable energy development business before they got into Bitcoin mining. You know, I think it might just be that they started to grow at the right time last year when we were sort of emerging slowly from the bear market. And also, I mean, I think so many of these stocks just trade on narrative. And if you have someone who's really growing, really outperforming, the narrative is sort of takes hold, and a lot of mining equity investors just start to jump after the sort of hottest name. But, you know, I think they've also, credit to CleanSpark, they've done a great job of executing, it seems. Taylor Monning, who I think is their new CTO, I believe, he's brilliant when it comes to mining ops. So credit to them for being able to actually execute. I think there are many such cases of mining companies that aren't able to really execute on operations, even when they can raise a bunch of money or spend a bunch of money. But, you know, so I think with CleanSpark, they do have a background in renewables. They are still focused on renewable energy. And I think they're also doing a good job leaning into the revitalization of American industry narrative, which I think is really important right now, especially. But, you know, I guess maybe also just to bridge that gap too, from talking about, you know, CleanSpark outperforming earlier this year and most miners underperforming, I think we have actually seen that dynamic shift a little bit post-halving, where hash price, originally, you know, we pumped because of runes. And by the way, hash price is basically, for a listener who's not sure, it basically is the US dollar revenue per unit of hash rate that a miner can expect to earn on any given day. So it's a function of Bitcoin price, transaction fees, and network hash rate. And so immediately post-halving, we saw runes lead to a massive run-up in transaction fees. The week thereafter, we saw hash price plummet to all-time lows. And surprisingly, not that much hash rate really switched off. I think this is probably because everyone's in expectation of a bull market since we saw all-time high before the halving. But the hash rate now seems to have stabilized. You know, as of this morning, it's something around $57 per petahash per second per day.
Currently 57. Yeah, 57, 58.
Yeah, so we've basically seen we've seen things normalize, and the TX fee vol is still, you know, still here. I think we both saw the OKX outbidding themselves for fees over the weekend as well. So miners are getting some relief here. And as a result, I think you're starting to see a lot of mining equities start to go back up as well. And I think it's probably as simple as the peak bearishness for miners was pre-halving. But now that we're through the halving, now that we're still seeing some relief and hash price isn't entirely dismal, we're seeing some recovery in these mining stocks as well.
Fantastic. And so, you know, one last question, I guess, in the mining stocks, and then I want to ask about fees, because I have the I have Luxor's hash rate index up. It's my personal favorite tool. An editor right now, you could pop up the URL on the screen so people can know what I'm talking about beneath Drew and I here. You can ask me for that in our Slack channel. But it's such a great tool because you could look at hash price, you could look at transaction fees. But anyway, my last question would be, like you mentioned, you said earlier on the year in a space with Dylan that you expected the ETFs to hurt MicroStrategy but help miners. Why do you think it's moved in the opposite direction? Do you think it's because now that the ETFs are in the space, the corporations are seeing, oh yeah, you know, Bitcoin corporate treasuries are something that's hugely viable, I'm going to use that for beta instead of mining stocks, which, because, you know, now they're becoming half as profitable per se. The block subsidy is getting cut in half. Do you think that that's the dynamic that people saw that has led to MicroStrategy doing well post ETF and the mining stocks doing poorly, or is it something else?
Yeah, it's a good question. And I wish I could tell you why MicroStrategy is performing so well post ETF. You know, I know there are many theories, but I'm still a little surprised, although I'm happy for Michael Saylor, don't get me wrong. I think, you know, when it comes to miners, there are some drawbacks to buying, a prop mining company versus buying spot Bitcoin or an ETF. Number one, you mentioned the halving. I think that was excuse alone for many investors to not buy a mining stock pre-halving, just because they didn't really know what would happen. And it didn't make sense to buy before such a negative catalyst. You know, I think there is also the fact that when you buy a mining stock, you're also paying for G&A that you don't pay for when you buy spot Bitcoin. I also personally think, and this is one of the reasons why we announced this deal with Kungsled and why we're so excited about it, I personally think that mining is a really, really challenging business. Even before you get into the operational aspect of it, you're always competing against rising network hash rate. And the unfortunate reality is it's perfectly competitive commodity production. So anyone anywhere in the world can plug in an ASIC. And it's not like other forms of, say, precious metals mining, where you buy a mine and the same amount of resources in the ground, no matter what happens in the external world. With Bitcoin mining, this is all algorithmic. And so the block subsidy is only going to go down. The difficulty adjustment comes for us all. And as a result, I think mining, there's certainly a lot of challenges to the business of mining. You know, even with Carisdale Capital, the folks who I think announced their public jihad against Bitcoin miners, I think even though they made a lot of crazy points, I think some of what they said, they're actually spot on with. And so this is something we're actually writing a shareholder letter right now for Cathedra. We'll be discussing more of these thoughts on Bitcoin mining then. But all in all, I think there is one aspect of Bitcoin mining that is a positive for Bitcoin miners that ETFs and MicroStrategy won't really enjoy, and that is transaction fees, as the initial question sort of gets at. And with the rise of, you know, BRC20, ordinals, runes, shitcoins, and now Bitcoin L2s, I think we're just going to see more and more of a demand for block space. And Bitcoin mining is the only real way to get exposure to those rising transaction fees, unless you want to use, speaking of Luxor, some paper product to get some synthetic exposure to those transaction fees. But if you buy an ETF, you're getting no exposure to Bitcoin transaction fees. And if, from a Bitcoin miner's perspective, your best shot at getting positive Bitcoin denominated returns on your investment in infrastructure is if transaction fees end up being really robust. And it's not just entirely the block subsidy. So sorry, that was a long rant, but I think you're dead on that. Transaction fees are probably one of the most interesting aspects of this new Bitcoin mining landscape we're in.
For sure. Absolutely. And in that vein, let me switch up the board here so you could see. I'm going to pull up the Luxor dashboard so you can see mining fees as a percentage of block subsidy. And we could clean this up a little bit to make it look better. But this is where we're at right now. You saw post-halving, they jumped to their highest percentage of the block subsidy ever, of like 60.2 or something like that. Now they're back down a little bit. We'll go back to a 7-day resolution. They're back down a little bit, so they spiked all the way up. But you could see, you know, intraday, intra-week, you could see they're going as high as like 170%, right? Strange.
Yeah, and I mean, that's only the 7-day chart too. So that spike right there isn't even runes or inscriptions. That's mostly the OKX fee issue from the weekend.
Right. And so these events occurring more and more often, I guess you being a guy that's just so immersed in the space, you're constantly thinking about, the microeconomics of all of this. When you see things like this happening, and you look out to the publicly traded miner landscape over the next, you know, 5, 10, several decades, what are your thoughts when you see something like this and how transaction fees are going to keep evolving as a percentage of, it's becoming so integral to the network, I suppose.
Yeah, no, I mean, it's a great question. I think as Bitcoin maxis, right? Because I was a maxi first before I was a miner. You always, you know, it was pretty easy to wrap your head around that a robust fee market will theoretically develop at some point, and that will solve the fact that we'll mine the last Bitcoin in 2139, whatever it is. I think the interesting thing looking at these charts is just it's the volatility of miner revenue and miner margin. And something I've talked about for a while is historically miners will earn the vast majority of their returns during that brief 12 to 18 month window during the bull market. You know, if you want to be really smooth brained around it, you just say bull market comes every 4 years. Miners are going to make the majority of their margins in that 12 to 18 month period. In a transaction fee dominated environment, what you basically see is it might even just be a 1 day or 1 week period where you have really, really elevated transaction fees, causing the majority of miner margins to just come during that one, you know, that one brief period where a bunch of people are trying to make some runes or mint some runes. And so it has a couple effects on the PubCo mining business, as you described. One, this sort of volatility is really hard to underwrite. And so you can't really plan for capital allocation decisions around expecting there to be transaction fees, or I guess you can, but it, really you need to position yourselves a little bit differently, which is you need to, you know, again, perhaps it's not so different than mining today. You need to position yourself for the downside so you can take advantage of the upside and not be totally dependent on there being transaction fees. I think one other aspect we might see is an increase in volatility of network hash rate as well. I think it will become more common to see low cost, low uptime hash rate on the network. And this would basically be, you know, transaction fees spike. So hash price goes above a certain threshold. Someone switches on a miner that really only makes sense at that elevated hash price level. But it's just a temporary hash rate that's not really going to be there, you know, 24/7, 365. This in turn could also make the network more dynamic and volatile as well. So transaction fees spike, causing hash price to spike. Miners plug in ASICs that are only ever going to be plugged in for a small minority of the time. That causes network hash rate to increase, which causes a decrease in block time, which could mean that we're eating through that mempool order book much faster. And then to the downside, say when the transaction fees subside, then you might see more hash rate coming offline, that temporary hash rate sort of going back into the on the bench. And then you see block times lengthen and sort of maybe a more natural dynamic sort of network that is responding in real time to these transaction fees. Whereas I think these days, if we see a pump in transaction fees, we're not really seeing more hash rate get plugged in because of it or hash rate come online because of it, because most of these people are thinking about, you know, 12 to 36 month capital allocation decisions. So I know it's sort of a long rant. It's a little, I don't think we're close to that yet. I think this is still in the realm of like Bitcoin mining sci-fi, but to me, it seems plausible and likely that that's where it's going to go.
Absolutely. And you mentioned that, you know, volatility like this is kind of hard to underwrite and it's tough. You know, companies don't make decisions on 7-day resolutions. They make these decisions on multi-year resolutions because ultimately that's the time frame on which you can, you know, get a loan, right? And actually go in and physically expand your operations. You know, even though Bitcoin mining is it's a commodity, mining business that anybody anywhere can plug in a machine and begin operating. When you're at scale, you kind of move a little bit slower. And so there's a little bit, I guess, wiggle room to capitalize and take advantage of these moments. I guess a question from that would be like, as a PubCo, as a mining company, you're operating at scale. How is it a little bit different from someone who may just, you know, be living in Oklahoma, have a couple of new machines and be able to plug it in and out? What are you guys doing to try and like stay flexible, to stay as profitable as possible? You know, when you're competing with, you know, when we're like comparing it to the flexibility of somebody that has like, you know, one or two machines, like what do big Bitcoin mining companies do to stay nimble in the face of all this volatility?
Yeah, it's a great question. And I would also, you know, just caveat a moment of humility and self-awareness here. We are a publicly traded mining company, but our fleet is around 400 petahash. So we are still quite smaller than the likes of Marathon, who are, you know, getting close to 20 exahash, I believe. So we're sort of in between the small miner and the big miner, but we can answer for both. I think one of the nice things when you're a retail miner is you don't really enter into a PPA, right? You're just plugging in your machine, you're paying a fixed retail rate, or if you're hosting with Compass, maybe it's a little bit different there. When you're a large miner, typically you're entering into longer term contracts, whether it's to purchase power directly from an energy company or hosting a machine, say, with a third party data center. It kind of ties into a broader theme or something I often think about with finance, which is, you know, in models, cash flow is continuous. In the real world, cash flow is discrete. You have moments of cash inflow, moments of cash outflow. Liquidity is more important, and there's some weird things that can happen at the margin there. So, for example, I think one of the reasons why network hash rate hasn't fallen off that much is because miners are either locked into these fixed PPAs or into a hosting contract, where if they unplug their machine in a hosting contract, they may lose their security deposit. If you're in a PPA and you just don't use that power, whether it's take or pay, or whether you're on the hook regardless, that could result in cash outflow anyway. So you might, especially in a period of short-term low hash price like we saw immediately after the halving, it might make sense for you to just keep the machines online in hopes that things improve, because you're choosing between knowingly losing money now or giving it a little more time, in which case maybe you'll be fine again. But I think the big thing that we do, and I think large public miners do this as well, but I think we've been particularly aggressive in doing this, is using firmware and underclocking and overclocking to optimize our operations. So right now, you know, we have sites across the country. We have different machines at each one of these sites, and depending on the economic structure of the contract we have at each site and what the network is doing, we will make the decision to underclock our machines or return them to factory default settings, basically changing the efficiency of our machines. Because if you underclock, you're pulling less power, but your hash rate is often reduced by a lesser percent than your power draw. So effectively, if you underclock by 50%, your hash rate may only decrease by 30%, which improves your overall efficiency. This is a strategy we actively employ, and we have rights reserved at all of our contracts to underclock at will without giving up the rights to the full power capacity.
Forgive me for interrupting and probably sounding like an idiot, but and I'm probably, it's not early in the morning, but I'm having my first coffee. What's the benefit of underclocking all of your machines rather than turning several machines off?
Yeah, so it's the difference in efficiency. So for example, if you take an S19J Pro, which is 30 joules of terahash out of the box, and you underclock it by 50%, meaning you're only pulling 1.5 kilowatts, you can still produce something like, 60, 65 to 70, depending on the machine, terahash per machine, which effectively means you've gone from 30 joules per terahash of stock efficiency to now call it 22, 23 joules per terahash of efficiency in the machine. And this means that you basically have leapfrogged the generation of efficiency from a machine. And so, to your point, you are in that case, if you leave the other machines, just if you turn off every other machine versus underclocking all the machines, you basically would, you'd be, in both cases, you're reducing your power, your revenue. In both cases, you're reducing your cost of energy, but your efficiency is worse if you're just shutting off 50% of the machines versus if you underclock all of them. And that's just how the silicon works.
All right. Fantastic. Perfect. That may have been a question viewers had. It's a question I had.
It's a great question. And it's sort of similar to, I think it's sort of, it's very imprecise in a way, it is precise because you're changing these settings like voltage and frequency, and you are, it has to do with semiconductor science at the end of the day, but it is very much sort of a trial and error type thing where you try different combinations to see what works, and you notice that it's not this like perfect linear descent, there's not this perfect one-to-one relationship. You just find these weird pockets where a machine can be more efficient or less efficient, and so it's definitely more of like an empirical practice versus a perfect science that's like easy for everyone to wrap their head around. And the only reason I know anything about this is because the guys on our team have taught me.
Excellent. That's how anyone learns anything, so it's fantastic. We got one thing I read the other day, and it's something that I've been living, and it's something you've been living too, is like, and this has nothing to do with mining, but you can't stop learning after graduation, and whether it's high school graduation, college graduation, after getting your master's, every single day you got to wake up and learn. And so it's so sick that, you know, you came into this and you've learned so much and now you're the president and chairman. It's wonderful. It's inspiring, frankly. It's inspiring to me. It's inspiring to a lot of the viewers. Last question I have, and then I want to kind of talk about your merger. I'm very interested in that and very interested in kind of the broader trend of consolidation in the mining space, is as a miner of your size, I guess, and then a miner that's much larger, say like Marathon, who also has, you know, a very large stock market capitalization behind them. What kind of people can you borrow from? What kind of entities can you borrow from for your capital allocation? And then what kind of terms do you guys get on your loans and your lines of credit and things like that? I don't know if that's too private for your company.
No. And, you know, actually, so in my prior job at Galaxy, I actually was running the ASIC lending product. Fortunately, all of our loans performed that were issued in like 2021. But I definitely I kind of come from a debt capital markets background. And to your point, I had to teach myself everything about Bitcoin and how Bitcoin mining works. Much as anyone going down the rabbit hole needs to teach themselves a whole litany of things that they never thought they'd know. Just like you. So I think with debt capital markets, they're still currently closed, I'd say, for the most part. The reality is that we saw too many miners take on too much debt in the course of the 2021 bull market. Unfortunately,
Cathedra also capitulation events as a function of that, I think.
Exactly. That's exactly right. And, you know, we talk about a lender having to foreclose on 30,000 machines because the borrower just refused to pay. I think that's part of the reason why we saw ASIC prices remain so low and so flat over the course of the last few years. Just because there was so much supply that hit the market, to your point, total capitulation. I think with Bitcoin mining right now, most of the financing is done via equity. And so that's why you've seen, all these ATM offerings. So many miners have been using them just to raise capital, to fund their futures orders, to fund operations. It's also a little bit sneaky with an ATM because you will register with the SEC saying, hey, I'm going to raise, you know, say $500 million worth of equity at some point in the next year or two. But once you do that initial press release, you really only inform the market that you've used it after the fact. And so each day, the way the ATM works is you register, I'm going to raise $500 million worth of equity. Each day you work with the bank and the bank says, hey, based on liquidity today, we think that we can sell this many shares for this price. Do you want to or no? And then the miner will choose to do so or not choose to do so. And then, you know, in their quarterly financials, they'll basically come out and say, hey, so actually we raised $200 million last quarter. You may not have noticed it, but we raised $200 million last quarter. That's how the majority of it's being financed right now. I think you're starting to see debt capital markets come back a little bit, but in a different way. I think we're talking about more bespoke one-off loans, not really like a blanket ASIC-backed debt offering that was really popular last cycle. You can always also borrow against your Bitcoin. I think that's like the best, for me, that's the most mispriced risk in the world if you're a lender. Like if you look at a company like Unchained, if I had infinite capital or if I could borrow at, you know, at 5%, I would just be buying Unchained loans all day because, you know, no losses and really juicy yields on that. But I digress. So, I think the majority, if there is a debt right now in Bitcoin mining, it is mostly either, say, from Bitcoin loans, Bitcoin-backed loans, these bespoke offerings. You are actually starting to see a lot more HPC debt, or, you know, lenders seem to be more comfortable lending against GPUs and high-performance compute data centers than Bitcoin miners, perhaps rightfully so. But I think those are really the main flavors of Bitcoin mining debt right now. There isn't really a huge bid for just prop mining Bitcoin debt. And that's because so many lenders got wrecked last cycle. And it turns out that the order book for ASICs and sites maybe isn't as thick as people originally thought.
Got it. Fantastic. So yeah, shifting gears into your merger. Let's talk about that a little bit. So can you share kind of some of the details behind the strategic rationale behind that decision and what the merger is going to involve?
Yeah, definitely. So I think over the last 2 years, AJ and I, when we first took over Cathedra, we were running really hard at the flared gas mining opportunity. We started developing and manufacturing our own data centers in northern New Hampshire. basically trying to revitalize American industry, and also own our own supply chain, because lead times back then in Q4 21, Q1 22, lead times for everything was absolutely bonkers. And that was mostly just due to COVID supply chain disruptions. But then the European energy crisis, and really what resulted in a sort of a global energy crisis, just changed the economics of off-grid Bitcoin mining. You used to be able to lease a generator for around 3 cents, 3.5 cents per kilowatt hour, and you could buy the gas for maybe half a cent per kilowatt hour. So if you build the box and if you're ready to go deploy and you have a really smart team, which we did, you can go. You would have been able to go plug in some ASICs at 4 cent power, being completely off-grid, so not being beholden to regulations or as much regulations as many of the on-grid miners. Unfortunately, the European energy crisis completely flipped that, and you started needing to pay 7-8 cents a kilowatt hour for the generators. That just completely changed the whole dynamic for off-grid mining. Also, we saw over the course of 2022, hash price just kind of go off a cliff as Bitcoin tanked, and you know, Luna happened, BlockFi happened, FTX happened. Bitcoin price tanks down to 17K, hash price is at 55 bucks per petahash per second per day. And really, it was just a horrible time to be a Bitcoin miner. So, you know, we basically, in that world, that's when we actually started doing a lot of the work on underclocking, where we just wanted to, you know, as fiduciaries, it's our job just to make sure that we're not burning cash every month, and that we're cash flow positive. So we made a bunch of hard changes there, and kind of gathered our feet under underclock machines at largely third-party operations or small data centers that we control. But we basically had to have a bit of a come-to-Jesus moment after that strategy that we were so animated by and we cared so deeply about kind of blew up in our face because the tides of the market shifted. And so I think over the last year or two, we really just done a lot of sober thinking about the industry. And, you know, as we chat with different folks in the industry, we've known these Kungsleden guys for a long time. You know, Tom and Gavin, they're two of the sharpest operators in the space. And they've done an amazing job of building a business where they'll be managing, within a month here, 90 megawatts worth of capacity, and the company will be less than 2 years old. So they've done an amazing job of that. And we think they're incredibly talented. And so, I mean, I think one of the big meta lessons for me in just business in general, and this isn't an original insight, it's one I've stolen from many people, just the importance of having really talented people and the most talented team you can. And so that's, I think, one of the big reasons that we wanted to do a deal with them. But also with this transaction, we'll now be moving into the business of running hosted data centers or hosting data centers for other people. And so this way we can kind of get off the ASIC hamster wheel. And we can just build a data center, with whatever it is, 5-10 year useful life, earn fixed margins on that, use those margins to stack Bitcoin, and basically insulate ourselves a little bit from the volatility of hash price. And, you know, we think there are some folks who are probably better at timing the market than us, who can probably succeed doing prop Bitcoin mining, but it's just not a game that we particularly care to play in. So I think we'd rather develop some of that supporting infrastructure and also secure rights to cheap power, because we think that will be one of the most important resources as we think about the next 10 years.
Absolutely. Fantastic. So for you guys, within this merger, how is this going to position you guys for future growth? Because it's obviously a pretty big pivot in strategy. I kind of ask you the rationale, but what do you expect to gain from this merger? And then over the next, 5 to 10 years, how do you expect that this is going to position you guys for future growth with this strategy pivot?
Yeah, it's a great question. And I think one of the reasons for the strategy pivot is that, looking taking a sober step back and looking at the market over the last year, seeing everyone, compete in this hash rate arms race, we're just not as well capitalized as Marathon. And so it feels foolish for us to try to play that same game as them. But so thinking like tactically, like what does it get us? What do we want to do over the next 5-10 years? And how does this fit into that? I mentioned the team, but then just think about the assets and the business model. Managing 90 megawatts of data center capacity with fixed margins just will provide a stable source of cash flow. Additionally, they were able to build those data centers at a historical average cost of 170K per megawatt, which is about, a third of what the call it FMV would be of what Marathon buys some other hosted data centers at. And certainly
fair market value for the viewers.
Sorry, fair market value. I don't mean to use too much.
Fine. That's fine. I just interjected. Hopefully the delay is not too bad between us.
Not at all. No. So I think, basically we're able to build it for cheaper than other people and certainly cheaper than what other people are paying right now. The stable cash flows paired with the fast, cheap development of data centers means that, you know, we may not need to just to rely on these ATM offerings like other miners to grow. We can use our free cash flow, either hold it in Bitcoin or develop new data center capacity in order to grow in a more sustainable way. And then, you know, as we think about over the course of the next year, we certainly would like to get listed on NASDAQ, which would help with liquidity for our shareholders, access to capital in general. I think this ties into, you know, something that itself could be a whole conversation, which is really AI and HPC. I think when you have the ability to develop these data, to develop simple tier zero Bitcoin mining data centers, what you get really good at is finding cheap power and developing projects in a clever, prudent way that doesn't cost a ton of money. And so that, we believe, that development model can be applied to other types of data centers as well. And we're seeing more and more of a bid for AI and high performance compute data centers throughout the country right now. And we think it'd be very natural adjacent market to grow into. Maybe not trying to compete with hyperscalers providing tier four data centers, but providing fit for purpose data centers to someone that needs a specific type of compute. And so with that, we potentially have the ability to diversify our revenue streams even more instead of prop mining and hosting for Bitcoin miners, potentially hosting for other markets as well. And we think that this will just make us a much more resilient business that's better able to withstand bear markets. And if you have fixed margins during a bear market, just means you can stack more Bitcoin for less. At the end of the day, we still very much believe in Bitcoin. We just think this might be a better way to accumulate more Bitcoin.
Extremely well said. Very well said. And like you said, you know, having a fiduciary responsibility to shareholders as well, I think this is a huge move and a very, very savvy move. So talk about this broader trend of consolidation that you're seeing in mining. You just talked about your own merger. How do you see this broader trend, right? If more companies decide to consolidate, how do you see this impacting the mining industry? And, obviously PubCos and the way that they trade, but also the mining industry as a whole.
Yeah, no, it's a great question. And I think really there was some M&A activity in years past, but I think really I think about this era starting, the 2021 Bitcoin bull market and sort of the aftermath. And that's largely because in 2021 is really when we saw a huge proliferation in the number of PubCo miners. And so the first real merger, the first major transaction that happened then was the Hut 8 US Bitcoin Corp merger, which took a long time to close, but I think was a telling data point of sort of what is to come. You had a large legacy Bitcoin mining company in Hut 8 that was had been in the public markets for years, and you had a small upstart a big upstart private company that was looking eventually to go public, had a ton of growth to offer this PubCo that didn't really have many great growth prospects. And so bringing them together, you combine team expertise, it hit scale. And so I think many miners looked at that and said, okay, this is probably going to be the start of something. We were actually the next that happened after that. We announced our deal in March of this year. And, I've kind of explained about the rationale, but again, sort of a similar situation where for a variety of reasons, the deal made sense for all of us. And the fact that we already have a close relationship made it very easy at the end of the day to get comfortable doing this together. But now I think we're seeing a lot more of these data points pop up. Just earlier this week, you saw Bitdeer announce the purchase of DeziMiner for $140 million all-stock deal. Now, that's a little bit different because DeziMiner actually is an ASIC manufacturer. And Bitdeer is a prop miner that also develops its own ASICs. And so that merger is more of, I think, is probably more strategic than necessarily just two large businesses doing the same thing, merging together for scale. But you're starting to see more of it as well, where, Riot has attempted a hostile takeover bid for Bitfarms. That one seems to be more of a scale play, where Riot is seeing that Mara and CleanSpark are moving a little bit ahead of it. you know, they're looking at Bitfarms, which, you know, maybe some might say is good relative value. They certainly have some great operators like Ben Gagnon. And so that merger is sort of more of a, you know, merge two entities, get bigger operations, get to larger scale, so it's easier to get investor mindshare. And then, you know, you're basically bringing expertise, but there are probably a lot of synergies there as well. And then lastly, you know, CoreWeave, recently as part of this deal that they did with Core Scientific for HPC hosting, they also actually offered to buy the business for $1 billion. And so, you know, I've thrown out a ton of different data points there, but I think what people are basically saying is they're looking around, and if you're a prop miner, there are, you know, what is it, 20, 30 publicly traded prop mining companies that all seem to be doing the same thing. It seems like there are too many of them and there should probably be some consolidation there, but also people are starting to be a little more savvy around the consolidation. I think people are starting to realize that, you know, just announcing a futures order and then plugging those machines in isn't really going to cut it anymore in terms of capturing investor attention. You need to be doing something interesting, whether that's moving into HPC, you know, developing your own ASICs. But I, you know, I think we have too many companies that are undifferentiated. So there's naturally going to be some consolidation there. And each consolidation will have some implications on the pro forma strategy for the company.
100%. And the CoreWeave, Core Scientific deal particularly is like a huge example of a company differentiating itself from the pack. Let's talk about AI. And this is a great segue that you just talked about. I think we get more to dive into here. AI, HPC, and miners, right? Unpacking the CoreWeave and Core Scientific deal. Explain what AI and HPC are, how miners can use these technologies, and kind of, and then we'll talk about like the impact on hash rate. But first and foremost, what is the CoreWeave and Core Scientific deal specifically, and how are they integrating AI, HPC? How do they plan to into their mining?
Yeah, no, it's a great question. I think that one in a way is sort of the real shot across the bow. And I think, you know, this AI, HPC, what does this really mean? HPC refers to high performance compute. It's something that's been in mining pitch decks for like, you know, 7 years now, basically the entire time I've been in Bitcoin mining. And it's really just plugging in GPUs instead of ASICs. But, you know, these GPUs could be used for a variety of things, whether that's image rendering, training large language models, or, you know, doing other forms of compute. When people say HPC, you can really think of it as like GPUs, but instead of shitcoin mining, you have a customer. And you're selling compute to that customer. This is not, so it's not brand new to Bitcoin mining. In fact, CoreWeave, one of the companies that we mentioned here, they actually started out as an ETH miner using GPUs. And then fortunately, right around the proof of stake merge, that's right around in 2022, that was right around the time when AI really took off with the advent of things like Stable Diffusion and the increased use of ChatGPT. And so, they basically, the market sort of perfectly came to them in a way. And then they pivoted much more into, you know, selling compute to other companies. Similar, there are two other data points of Bitcoin miners that have been on this HPC train for quite some time. Number one, you have Hive, which is one of the first publicly traded mining companies in Canada. They had GPU mining for a very long time. And then they sort of have pivoted into AI HPC. And then the other name from before this cycle would be Crusoe, which started out doing off-grid Bitcoin mining using waste methane, but then they've now basically entirely pivoted to, you know, Crusoe Cloud Services. You'll hear their ads on some podcasts. And so, you know, it's a trend that was in the industry for a while, but I think post-2022 and in 2023 with the whole AI craze, more and more Bitcoin miners started taking it seriously. And I think before the demand for AI compute, it was at least unclear to me whether this whole thing was just a giant LARP. But now it feels like the demand is really there. And there are tons of data points to suggest this, whether it's Amazon buying, you know, hundreds of megawatts of capacity at a site that historically has been used to mine Bitcoin at the Susquehanna nuclear power plant owned by Talon in Pennsylvania. But, you know, a lot of you're starting to see a lot of these hyperscalers really go after compute and really try to secure stable energy resources for their compute, for their HPC data centers. And so as a result, you're seeing a lot of large pubco miners follow suit, whether it's Iron is doing a lot of work there. I know Bit Digital's done a lot of work as well. And again, you're seeing different types of business models, whether it's hosting someone else's GPUs or buying GPUs yourself and running GPUs and providing services to others. It's in a way quite similar to Bitcoin mining, where some people want to own the silicon and own the risk there. But it's quite capital intensive. Some people just want to build the infrastructure to host someone else's silicon. And so I think let's just talk quickly about the CoreWeave Core Scientific deal. And forgive me for rambling, but it's just something I've been thinking a great deal about. I think with CoreWeave, it's quite interesting because what they've done is they've entered into a hosting contract with Core Scientific to retrofit 200 megawatts of Bitcoin mining data center capacity for GPUs. They estimate this will cost something like $300 million. CoreWeave is providing the CapEx to Core Scientific to make this conversion. And there will be a hosting contract, I believe at around 17 cents per kilowatt hour, is the fixed revenue that Core Scientific will earn. But interestingly, the CoreWeave CapEx contribution will be credited back to them over the course of the contract. Think about it as almost like a loan in a way, where they're funding the CapEx, they'll get credited back over time. But from Core Scientific's point of view, CapEx free expansion, and all of a sudden they'll be earning 17 cents per kilowatt hour for their hosting of these GPUs versus the market rate for Bitcoin mining of seven and a half cents. Or even in Bitcoin mining, if you bought a Bitmain S21, right now it's only earning about 13 cents per kilowatt hour. So it's just a much higher value use of a kilowatt hour. And so it's natural that you're seeing CoreSci get into this and many other miners follow suit.
Lots to be said there, and we're going to say it at the very end, but if you haven't already, follow Drew on X. He's a wealth of knowledge when he does tweet, because I know he is very busy, but we'll talk about it again at the end, but really great stuff, man. I want to shift gears here into talking about geopolitical shifts, the impact on hash rate of AI HPC, and then we'll kind of talk about what hash rate is doing right now, where it's going country-wise. You wrote that miners may be leaving the U.S. for cheaper power as a result of AI HPC. And I guess we could also maybe ask about kind of a political question, right? Come this November, obviously TBL is not a political outlet, but we know that one candidate is avowedly pro-Bitcoin and the other candidate is very much anti-Bitcoin, anti-crypto largely, even though it's shown to be an extremely unpopular position to take. That's the position they're taking. So what are miners doing right now? Are you seeing them leaving the U.S.? Are you seeing them coming to the U.S.? What are the geopolitical trends? Where is hash rate going?
Yeah, it's a great question. And to your point around politics, I also agree, Bitcoin, perhaps in my view, an apolitical technology, but what's the old line? You might not be interested in politics, but politics is interested in you.
Politics is interested in you? Yeah.
I think actually exactly. I stole that from I think it's a great question. And kind of rewinding the tapes, really, the growth of Bitcoin mining in the U.S. is a pretty recent phenomenon. The early days of mining, it was all Chinese mining because they had access to the fastest ASICs. ASICs, as soon as they were ready, they were able to plug them in very fast at cheap power in basically some data centers that were fit for purpose, but didn't exactly have shiny floors. Then in 2021, there was the Chinese mining ban. And that obviously coincided with the Bitcoin bull market, where you were seeing, again, a proliferation of PubCo miners in the U.S. And so, I think what we basically kind of saw, this shift of mining to the U.S. was caused by the Chinese mining ban, the fact that the U.S. is the best capital markets in the world, the fact that the U.S. protects property rights, and the fact that U.S. is also an energy capital of the world. And so all of those conspired to basically once, in the 2021 bull market, a lot of hash rate went to the U.S., after the Chinese mining ban, this only increased, and the U.S. went from, call it 10% of the network maybe in 2019 to 35% of the network, call it, come 2022. And so I think this is that trend made sense. And the fact that the U.S. mining companies had better access to capital than basically anyone else in the world made it particularly attractive place for hash rate. Some of the other places that saw mining move to after the China ban, like Kazakhstan, quickly rugged some of their miners. And so the U.S. seemed like one of the better places to go plug in your machines if you needed to. But now that AI HPC has come in and they're providing this massive source of demand for energy that might otherwise be used for Bitcoin mining, I think you're going to see that shift a little bit. Now, it's worth being said, Bitcoin mining has a very different power profile than a HPC data center. HPC data centers are maybe much more conscious of uptime, or they care much more about uptime and stable, reliable power versus Bitcoin miners, which are happy to switch off if they get cheaper power. But also HPC is happy to pay more for their power historically than Bitcoin miners. But I think what you'll start to see is more of this conversion of legacy data centers, like this Core Scientific data center to HPC from Bitcoin mining. I think you'll also see sites that maybe 2 years ago only a Bitcoin miner would have competed for. You might now see more and more GPU data centers come and try to compete for, and basically they have a higher willingness to pay. And so as a result, you might see some miners getting outbid, and you might even see energy prices increase naturally anyway, because we kind of have a lack of investment in baseload generation in the US right now anyway. And the volatility of intermittent energy resources like wind and solar increase volatility on the grid, which potentially increases price for all customers. But the net effect is it might get more expensive to mine Bitcoin here in the US. Meanwhile, you have places that are further out on the geopolitical risk curve, maybe places like Africa or South America or places in the Middle East that are still need an energy sink, and that maybe will have lower cost of power in sort of the 1 to 4 cent range than most folks can get in the US, certainly without a PPA. And so I think it's sort of natural that you might see Bitcoin mining and hash rate shift away from the US again. There will still be some in the US, and you may even see Bitcoin mining integrated with HPC data centers in some interesting ways. But a lot of the hash rate that doesn't have sort of some auxiliary use case or some auxiliary benefit might shift over to these developing countries. And as a result, you'll actually see a greater diversification of hash rate globally, which I think is very good for Bitcoin. It's basically, as Brandon Quidham wrote about years ago, you know, Bitcoin's a pioneer species. After it's created how many gigawatts worth of substations in West Texas, those substations might now be used for HPC. And instead, ASICs will again migrate to the places with the cheapest power, which could be countries in sub-Saharan Africa or elsewhere.
Extremely well said. I mean, great. You consolidated a huge amount of Bitcoin mining movement geopolitically into just a 5 or 6 minute answer. So that was great. We're going to clip that, and we're going to tag you in it. Perfect. Great thing for you to share. Wonderful. So, you know, we have a couple minutes left here. I want to talk about, you called yourself a monetary maximalist, which I would also consider myself a monetary maximalist. Let's talk about the increased bid for block space. We just saw the mempool. I tried to send a transaction twice over the weekend. It was at like 400 sats per V-byte. I was like, all right, maybe I'll wait a little bit. The mempool has been full, and then it's not full, and then it's full, and then it's not full. And that's always the story for Bitcoin, right? But layer two solutions are on the rise. Runes are on the rise. You talked about how transaction fees spiking before the halving. That was as a result of runes coming online, et cetera. A great deal of other things that are now happening on Bitcoin, native to Bitcoin. So with the rise of these layer two solutions and other things that are taking up block space, how do you see the demand for block space evolving? And how are miners going to have to position themselves in the face of that?
You know, it's a great question. I think to answer the second part first, I think we talked already about how transaction fee volatility will be on the rise. I think miners are very smooth brained. You know, it's like Grug Dev, but Grug Miner. We just buy machine plugin and don't have time to think about things like opcat or transaction fees. And so, you know, for us, we're surprised to the upside. What it means is our revenue is more volatile. So maybe we hedge more. Maybe we try to position ourselves a little more defensively. Maybe we have some hash rate in the wings ready to switch on if transaction fees spike. But it basically, the ground is getting a little shakier, and that could be for better, could be for worse. I think in terms of the network, I think what we're really seeing is that it's almost like Murphy's Law, but for block space, right? Like any potential use of block space will be tried, whether that's NFTs or meme coins or L2s, sidechains, whatever you want to say. And personally, I think we're probably going to see I think we're going to see a lot of this tried, a lot of this failed. I think there's going to be a lot of froth, and it feels like L2 might be the next hype cycle for all this stuff. But I think, you know, at the end of the day, what will probably happen is maybe of the 100 L2s that are going to be tried, maybe one of them might actually get some traction as a way to, if you need to save state to a blockchain and it needs to be more secure than Ethereum or Solana, maybe there's a use case for it to be done on Bitcoin. Maybe there's a use case for inscribing data onto the Bitcoin blockchain that isn't just a JPEG. You know, maybe people actually care enough about JPEGs that they'll continue to do this. But, you know, I think in the end of the, you know, at the end of the day, all of this will be tried. This will make it more expensive in moments to transact on the Bitcoin blockchain. But I think, again, sound money will win. And, you know, some half-assed tweet I had a couple of months ago, you know, Jevons paradox, but for block space. I think we'll start to see more and more of these roll-up type or L2 technologies used to try to improve the scalability of Bitcoin. Now, it will probably mean that not everyone in the world has a UTXO on chain. I'm not sure if everyone in the world wants a UTXO on chain or will want a UTXO on chain. But, you know, I think it's the kind of meta approach I try to take to all this nonsense, because, you know, as a monetary maximalist, you do look at it and you know, you do wonder why anyone wants to gamble on a BRC20. I think it is a good stress test for Bitcoin. Hopefully it brings more people to Bitcoin with laser eyes and converts some folks who maybe before were in it just for, you know, the gambling casino type use case. But I'm hopefully optimistic that more folks will sort of come to the monetary maximalist view. And there are many scaling solutions, whether it's Lightning, centralized banks that basically the ability to withdraw the UTXO as a check on their fractional reserve policies or whatever it may be, or other solutions that will increase the usability of Bitcoin, even if it doesn't mean everyone in the world has a UTXO on chain. But anyway, those, I actually think you probably have a more enlightened take on this than I do. So I would love to hear what your thoughts are, or perhaps you've written them elsewhere.
Yeah, for sure. I mean, for me, it's like you're dead on when this is a stress test for Bitcoin. It's seeing what the network can handle. And it's also accelerating the development of L2. Because at the end of the day, what Bitcoin is to me, and the core use case of Bitcoin is better money. And it's better money for anyone in the world. It's the single kind of catch-all solution to everything that all countries are facing, but particularly, like, obviously, you know, less developed nations, but here in the West, for the very first time, all of us are now facing like the acute pain that's involved with what happens when your government no longer works for you and it's just doing runaway deficit spending and it's allowing banks to buy T-bills with money created out of thin air in order to do that, which makes it so that not only there are literally zero checks in the government anymore with how it spends because they don't care, but now they're printing money out of thin air to do it, which also really acutely hurts people. And so Bitcoin is what people need to allocate to in order to insulate themselves from that. That's the main thesis of the Bitcoin Layer, our research firm. That's my main thesis, is that, like, you know, there's really no stopping this. Cycles all resolve in the exact same way. So we need more people to have Bitcoin, and we need more people to hold Bitcoin the way it was intended, which is, you know, holding their own keys. And so as these other things take up block space, and as we're kind of working on a very limited calendar here, all things considered, Bitcoin will be around forever, as long as, you know, obviously, you know, until Jesus comes back and the world ends, you know, Bitcoin will be around forever, right? And so it's kind of a thing where as these things develop, as these new things happen, it kind of radicalizes people, I guess, against any other use case that isn't money for Bitcoin. And then in doing so, it leads people who are way smarter than me to begin developing solutions, scaling solutions, to make it so that even though the main chain may get clogged, right, people can still transact with Bitcoin and use it the way it was intended. So completely agree. I think this does radicalize people. You know, I'm not a very technically oriented guy when it comes to computing, but certainly my job, you know, I feel in Bitcoin is just to explain the problem, point people to the solution. As more technical people than me are pointed to the solution, they'll see that, you know, what are these people uploading photos of monkeys on the blockchain for? This pisses me off. I'm going to go work toward the development of other solutions. So yeah, no, I think you're dead on. I think it radicalizes people and it pushes people more toward monetary maximalism. And so I'm not necessarily going to demonize these things. I think allowing them, because I can't do anything about it, allowing them to play out as they are playing out impacting economics the way that they are, I think that's just the way the cookie is going to crumble, personally.
No, I think that's spot on. And I think there's also the question of the best way to combat the graffiti folk is not to say that we need to like ban your transactions and censor your transactions, you know, but basically wait for the market to naturally do its thing.
And to let their graffiti eventually fill up the entire wall until enough people walk by and go, you know, I really, really hate this graffiti, and then do something about it.
Exactly.
Fantastic, man. Awesome. Well, you know, I suppose we'll leave it there. I guess any parting thoughts on kind of the mining market backdrop, what you guys are doing over at Cathedra, anything else you want to talk about before we close out?
You know, I think we covered a lot today. But no, I'm really excited for the back half of this year, both for Bitcoin, for a lot of people waking up to the importance of Bitcoin and getting some new converts. It seems like buying Bitcoin is now decidedly in the Overton window for most Americans and most large money managers. And then on the Cathedra side, I'm really excited about this transaction with Kungsleden. Really excited about trying to pursue a U.S. listing later this year, and you know, just continue to try to secure as many stable energy resources as possible, so we can help facilitate much needed compute, whether for Bitcoin security or otherwise.
Absolutely. You know, personally, if I was working at the New York Stock Exchange, you know, I would make it as easy as possible for you guys to get listed to raise capital, because, you know, with you and AJ at the helm, you guys have an extremely bright future, and you've clearly showed, you've demonstrated time and again, and you've explained clearly in this interview how you think on your feet, you pivot, and you're always working for the shareholders. So best of luck in your pursuit of getting listed in the U.S. This year, if I heard that correctly. Best of luck in that.
Inshallah, yes.
Phenomenal. Absolutely. All right. Well, that's everything, man. Before we head off, you know, Drew Armstrong, president and chairman of Cathedra Bitcoin, where can people find more of what you're doing? Where can they follow along with you?
Yeah. So you can go to Twitter or x.com and follow me @_DrewArmstrong_, or go to cathedra.com, sign up for our updates. We'll continue to post them out. We also have a blog that we publish, pieces that we find interesting when things aren't so crazy that we have time to write. So, but yeah, thanks again, Joe, for having me on here. As I said before, AJ and I have been, avid readers of the Bitcoin layer and love, love all you guys' analysis. And I think some of the better, macro analysis in Bitcoin. So thank you.
Thank you very much. I appreciate that. Well, you heard the man, go follow him. Also @DrewArmstrong on X, and, yeah, Drew, thanks for being on. We'll talk to you soon. Take it easy, everyone. Thank you. Thanks so much for watching. Another special thanks to the good folks over at River. They are the sponsor of the Bitcoin Layer and our Bitcoin exchange of choice. They have 100% full reserve cold storage custody, so all the Bitcoin that you buy with them, you know you can sleep with peace of mind knowing that you've invested in Bitcoin with confidence. They also have US-based phone support. They're fully licensed and regulated, and when you set up a recurring order with them, so if you buy Bitcoin weekly, or even daily or monthly, whatever resolution you choose, you're not going to be charged a fee on those purchases. And that's great, because dollar cost averaging, or those recurring payments, is the best way to invest in Bitcoin on a long time frame. It gives you the best returns compared to lump sum payments. So check them out at river.com. And when you use our link, river.com/TBL, you can get up to $100 in Bitcoin when you make your purchase. That's right, river.com/TBL to claim that offer of up to $100 in Bitcoin when you buy some Bitcoin. That's all for today. Once again, thanks so much for watching, and we'll talk to you soon. Take it easy.